U.S. is calling out China. Moms are in need of help. And the teenagers are here to save the day, or at least try. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Rima Khreis, and for Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, July the 19th. Good to have you with us. One of the big headlines of the day, the U.S. is publicly blaming China for a massive cyber attack done earlier this year, for breaching Microsoft email systems used by organizations and businesses around the world. And so it wasn't just the U.S. that pointed its finger at China. NATO, the EU, and a handful of other countries joined in. But all of this public shaming was, well, just that. Members of the alliance did vow to work together to, you know, disrupt cyber threats and defend each other against them. But these promises of cooperative security and threat alerts, they don't have actual teeth. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer looks at some of the more forceful options the Biden administration might consider.
Option one, treat China more like Russia by sanctioning government officials involved in cyber attacks or expelling Chinese diplomats from the U.S. But these first two options risk further destabilizing the close economic relationship between the U.S. and China, says Weifeng Zhang, a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center.
I think it's inevitable that when we try to enhance national security, we'll have to make some sacrifices.
Like maybe Hollywood would have to sacrifice some profits because Chinese officials could limit the number of U.S. films that could be shown there. A third option for the U.S., retaliate with its own cyber attacks. But that's risky, too. Meg King, a cybersecurity expert at the Wilson Center, says the U.S. could inadvertently shut something down it didn't mean to. And
the risk that you might either let some sort of malicious software malware escape that then you as a country are responsible for is a big risk as well.
King says other countries could also misunderstand the intent behind a U.S. cyber attack and respond in unexpected ways. That's where today's announcement could help. Andrew Lone, a senior cybersecurity fellow at Georgetown University, says right now the U.S. is trying to get buy-in from its allies for any future options.
But they need to build up that support publicly and internationally, in order for them to have larger scale actions.
Beijing hasn't said much in response to this public shaming by the U.S. and its allies. In the past, China's foreign ministry has said Beijing firmly opposes and combats cyber attacks in all forms. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
You know who's having a pretty good summer? Home builders. That's who. This morning, the National Association for Home Builders released their sentiment index for July, and it edged down a bit, 1 point from June. But that still leaves builder sentiment in the very optimistic range, higher than any time before the pandemic, going all the way back to the mid-1980s. Of course, though, that does not mean it's not facing some problems, because let's be real, everyone has problems. Home builders are facing everything from supply chain bottlenecks and soaring material prices to shortages of skilled labor and land for development. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has more.
Optimism has cooled off a bit since the fall, when the economy started reopening and would-be buyers could come kick the floorboards and model homes again. Robert Dietz is chief economist at the National Association of Home Builders.
We've moved from an extremely hot housing market to a simply hot housing market.
Since the pandemic hit, a lot of work-from-home types have started looking for new digs, says Chuck Fouke, a custom builder in Tampa and chair of the Builders Association. Meanwhile, younger people want new homes for their growing families.
Quite frankly, we haven't built enough houses since 2010, and the demand is going to be strong probably for the next 10 to 15 years.
But right now, meeting that demand means navigating delays and double-digit price increases, says Robert Dietz.
Literally the nuts and bolts that go into building a home, whether due to global supply chain disruptions or the run-up in prices in steel and copper. Items that used to be guaranteed to arrive in weeks are now taking months, things like windows and doors, microwaves.
Which is wreaking chaos with home prices, says Chuck Fouke.
Right now, in many cases, our pricing is only good for maybe a week or two.
In the past year, the median price of a new home has gone from $317,000 to $374,000. Vivek Saw studies real estate at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas.
is pricing a lot of local buyers, especially first-time home buyers and minority home buyers, out of the market.
According to the National Association of Home Builders, every $1,000 increase in the price of a new home means 150,000 would-be buyers can't afford one anymore. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, it was not good. In fact, it was a pretty bad day, the worst day since May. The markets were freaked out over concerns about the spread of the Delta variant and what that could mean for travel and tourism, among other things. We'll have more details for you when we do the numbers. Many Americans have lost their jobs over the last year, but women, as we've talked about quite a bit on this show, have had it especially tough, forced to leave their jobs in record numbers to look after children stuck at home without access to affordable childcare. Last month, women's labor force participation fell to 56.2%, the lowest level since 1988. Phoebe Cohen is one of those women. She illustrated a piece in a publication called The Nib. In it, she talks about her decision to quit her job as a paramedic so she can take care of her son. Phoebe, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
So it sounds like you took on a new job because you had to look after your son. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, basically, at this point, I do a little food delivery with Uber Eats with my son in the back seat. And, you know, it was grinding. And the thing is also, I was in many ways one of the luckier ones when it comes to single mothers just trying to pay the bills while, you know, having absolutely no low-cost daycare or anything like that. I mean, I am suffering. My career is suffering, but right. I have my own car. I can do this.
And so as you're making these deliveries with your son in the back seat, how is he making sense of everything?
I think he realizes I'm in work mode. He's on the spectrum. He has ASD. But lately, he has been so good and so patient. Like, he's been understanding that this is something mommy has to do. And and he's been very good at the car. He loves riding in the car. And I am really grateful about what a good boy he's been. And I'm very touched because he shouldn't have to do this. He shouldn't, he should be with his friends. He should be playing outside. He should be in daycare. And you know, daycare is, of course, either he's much too old or they don't have the resources to handle a child with autism. Or they're just too expensive for me. So this is sort of a compromise that I shouldn't have to make.
So you've been doing this now through most of the pandemic, but before this, you were a paramedic.
Yes.
Can you tell me about that? Why did you make that shift?
I literally could not afford to work as a paramedic. Yeah. So in the area I'm in, a pretty rural area, but paramedics make about $17 an hour and the babysitters make $15 an hour. So I was literally working to pay the babysitter, and whatever $2 an hour net income I was making, of course, went to gas or to coffee or whatever. It was simply unsustainable for me. And I remember feeling the incredible injustice of it all, saying, this can't be right. There has to be some other alternative. And just realizing, the more I researched it, nope, because this daycare crisis has been allowed to persist because the people being affected by it are disproportionately women. And if women are the ones being disproportionately affected by it, it's seen as not an important crisis.
Well, you know, thinking about your career path, you started off as a paramedic, and it sounds like you envisioned having a career in the medical field. And now, you know, you're spending, it sounds like, most of your days driving around, delivering orders with your son in the back. And as you're, you know, doing all this, as you're trying to find the right apartment and, you know, making sure that your son's okay, what sorts of thoughts do you often find running through your head?
Well, just sadness and frustration, really, because I'm not advancing my career. I'm getting older. I'm not really building a retirement fund. I'm not saving up for those sort of those investments that previous generations made, like, you know, buying a house or getting a mortgage or anything. And yeah, we're stuck in a situation where we are not going to have a long-term financial cushion to support us into old age or to support our children if our children run into financial emergencies during their young adult lives.
Personally, for you, what needs to happen so that you're able to return to the career that you've already invested in?
It would have to be some sort of 24-hour, 7-day-a-week childcare. And that sounds like extreme, but no, so many women work careers where they're on a 24-hour work day where they have to take night shifts. We're talking about home health care providers, nursing home providers, nurses, and we need to be essentially funded in some way because child care providers themselves, who are disproportionately women, they also need to pay their bills. So an entire generation of women is getting locked out of the middle class. It has to be addressed and dealt with.
Yeah, yeah. Is that your son, by the way, that I'm hearing in the background?
Oh, can you hear him? Yeah, that's him.
Well, I'll let you get to him. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with me today. Phoebe Cohen is a mom. She is a freelance illustrator, paramedic, and a current Uber Eats driver. Thanks, Phoebe.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Over in Germany, extensive flooding has left hundreds of people dead and injured, wreaking havoc and causing billions of dollars worth of damage. The floods, which some European leaders blame on climate change, coincided with the EU's launch of a package of radical proposals to combat this environmental crisis. Among them is the world's first carbon border tax. That is, a tariff on imports from countries that are not aggressively tackling their own greenhouse gas emissions. The plan needs approval from all 27 member states and the European Parliament, and it wouldn't be implemented until 2026. But as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from the European desk in London, the idea of using trade policy to tackle climate change, it's not going over well.
The EU's means of achieving its planned cuts is to get its companies to pay for their carbon emissions. But there's a problem, says Simona Tagliapietra of the Bruegel think tank in Brussels.
If Europe decarbonizes quickly while others don't do the same thing, then the European industry becomes competitively disadvantaged.
The proposed tariff is aimed at reducing that disadvantage. It would apply initially to imports of things like steel, aluminium and cement from countries that haven't put a price on carbon. Michael Jacobs, an economics professor from Sheffield University, says the tariff could help the EU achieve its own emission cuts.
It will make it much easier to get the support of business and potentially of voters for the measure internally.
And could spur more international action.
I suspect it probably would encourage other countries who wouldn't want their exports to the EU to be penalised to impose stronger climate policies of their own.
But it's already aggravating trade tensions. Countries that would be hit by the tariff, China, Russia, Turkey and the North African states, call it protectionism, a complaint to the World Trade Organization is likely and could be difficult for the EU, says Emily Lydgate of the UK Trade Policy Observatory.
It's tricky to justify from a WTO perspective and to prove that it's non-discriminatory.
She says EU officials bent over backwards to ensure the proposal will pass the WTO test.
But I'm not sure that they'll succeed.
Oddly enough, some environmentalists have attacked the proposed tariff too, on the grounds that it will sour the atmosphere, ruin the climate, at the critical COP26 climate change conference in Glasgow in the fall. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
By the way, if you happen to miss Marketplace on the air, do not fret, do not worry. You can download this show as a podcast wherever you get them. Coming up.
I think I wanted to work, you know, start saving up.
Never too early to plan for the future, am I right? But first, let's do the numbers. Oh no, there are the wah-wah trombones. All right, let's get into it. The Dow Jones plunged 725 points, 2% to close at 33,962. The NASDAQ dropped 152 points, just over 1%, to finish at 14,274. And the S&P 500 slid 68 points, 1.5%, to end at 4258. The markets were already headed for a record drop by midday as fears about the Delta variant cut across different industries. I mentioned travel stocks earlier. They took a noticeable hit. American Airlines dipped 4.1%, and Carnival Corporation sank 5.7%. Oil, which has hit record high prices over the last few months, took a dive today after OPEC agreed over the weekend to boost output. ExxonMobil drained 3.4%, and Chevron fell 2.6%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.2%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Rima Khreis. So I don't have kids myself, but I can imagine that talking to them about money is not easy. If you're stressed out, do you answer them honestly? Do you water things down? Do you ignore them and hope this stream of questions eventually ends? Just kidding, probably shouldn't do that. But no, it is tough, especially during this last year with the pandemic and all the economic pain folks are feeling. Marketplace's Samantha Fields went out and talked with parents about how they are talking to their kids.
Kelly Johnson never used to talk to her kids about money or finances or anything like that.
I wasn't really thinking about it, to be honest.
For her kids or for herself. She worked a lot, 60 hours a week at a restaurant and at a gym as a personal trainer, but...
You know, it was so easy for me to make money before. It was never a thought in my mind that I wouldn't have money.
And so she felt comfortable spending it on things and on experiences for herself and her 8 kids. Then the pandemic hit, and both the gym and the restaurant where she worked in Florida closed. When her unemployment benefits took a long time to come through, Johnson ran out of money.
It made me think a lot more about it when I have a little bit of money to spend, that I make sure that I pay my mortgage and my bills first. I know for everybody else, they probably think, well, that's a no-brainer, but not for me, okay? I like to buy stuff.
The pandemic changed her entire approach to managing her own money. It also changed her feelings about talking to her kids about it, too.
I want to make sure that I give them the tools so that they can be successful financially. I will make sure that I instill in them some really good principles so that if anything in their lifetime ever happens like this again, that they won't fall apart.
That is important to Tanika Wilson, too. She's a single mom living in the Bronx in New York, and she'd started talking some with her 11-year-old son, Dylan, about budgeting and bills even before the pandemic.
So we have Friday nights as pizza night. So in order for us to have that, I need to set up all of my finances so we can have pizza night every Friday and then, you know, let him know how much the pizza costs.
The pandemic and all the uncertainty it caused made Wilson decide to ramp up those conversations.
About what is necessary and what is not necessary.
And about what it means to be responsible with money and how it is okay to buy treats like pizza sometimes, just not every time you feel like it.
There was a lot of conversations about saving and conservation and being more aware and more mindful, like really having more mindfulness about money.
It's important for parents to have those kinds of conversations with their kids, says Shipra Parikh, a social worker and professor at the University of Chicago, especially when times are uncertain.
Kids often really appreciate the honesty because they feel it, even if it's not told to them. They can feel an adult's emotion around insecurity, about money, about a job.
Often, Parikh says, the more resources a family has, the less parents talk to their kids about money.
A family's lived reality really kind of is the biggest predictor of how and when and why they talk to kids about money.
There are no studies yet about how the pandemic has changed the way parents talk to their kids about money. But many families' lived realities changed drastically in the last year. And even for those whose circumstances didn't change, so much in the world around them did.
So they would ask a lot of questions.
Kumar Cheda lives in Columbus, Ohio with his family. And he says his kids, who are 7 and 11, started picking up a lot just from listening to the news while making dinner.
The kids would hear something and say, hey, why is so-and-so happening in the economy or in the stock market?
His son, Vishnu, got so interested in the stock market that he started asking if he could get some stocks of his own.
So I've kind of offered him a chance to do some research and come back to me and say, hey, Dad, I'd like to buy this stock or that stock.
They ended up buying 3 that he picked, including 1 share of AMC, which they got for $5.
When it went up to $60, he wanted to hold on to it. And then when it went back down to like 40s, he was like, hey, should we sell it? I'm like, why don't you just hold on to it and let's see what happens over time?
It's been a lot of fun, Cheda says. And if it weren't for the pandemic, it's something that never would have occurred to him to do with his son at this age. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Speaking of talking to your kids about money, we've got a whole new season of our podcast made especially for kids to answer all the questions they have. It's called Million Bazillion, and you can find it wherever you get your podcasts. So this definitely doesn't apply to everyone, but I think for a lot of people, the first time they start seriously thinking about money, you know, like really trying to save and understand the value of it, is during their very first job, usually as a teenager. And right now, as businesses across the country are reopening and as a lot of employers are struggling to staff up, the teenagers have come to the rescue. The ratio of 16 to 19-year-olds who work reached nearly 32% in June, up from about 25% last June. And that brings us to today's segment of our ongoing series, My Economy.
My name is Yair Parada. I am from Denver, Colorado, and I am 18 years old. I just finished up high school.
My name is Anissa Woods. I am 17 years old, and I live in Crowley, Texas. I finished school with the GED.
Growing up, coming from like a middle class household, I think like money is sort of important. I think I wanted to work, you know, start saving up so like I'll be good for when I enter college. But I think like I was mainly like looking for more like experience and connections that I would be able to use in the future.
I'm saving for a car, and also I'm just saving because of rainy day funds. I have 11 siblings, so it was kind of hard growing up. Like food situations and clothing for all of those children. And I do want to support them. So I'm just trying to encourage them to like achieve greatness.
For rec right now, I'm currently a lifeguard for Denver Parks and Rec. And I started a couple years ago, but due to COVID, had to stop because pools shut down. And I restarted again this summer. I was pretty much on the swim team for like 5 years, and my swim coach put me on the job, and from then on, it's been a really fun experience.
I'm doing child care development. I'm currently working on getting a job to be an after-school teacher program director. I haven't started yet. I started my training, but it's fun working with kids, and I want to see like little kids achieve. I want to see them like go through school and have fun.
Right now, I make $15 an hour, but when I started lifeguarding, I got paid around like $11 an hour, and it didn't really move up to like after a couple months after I was working. So I think I would be able to work if they were like a little bit less money.
$11 an hour is okay for right now, but when I get older, I plan on like looking for something that has a better amount of money, but I'd rather do what I love and make less money than to do something that I don't like.
That was Yair Parada from Denver, Colorado, and Anissa Woods from Crowley, Texas. Let us know what's going on in your economy over at marketplace.org/myeconomy. All right, this final note on the way out today. Okay, so teenagers, they're helping fill that labor gap, right? But many companies, they're still kind of desperate right now. The unemployment rate for restaurants and bars is still high. It reached 10% last month. So I cannot believe I'm about to say this, but some companies are now taking their recruitment efforts to TikTok. Yeah, TikTok. You know, the app where people dance and make jokes and now apparently get jobs. The app recently launched a pilot program, something called TikTok Resumes, where folks can send in their resumes in video form. Chipotle, Target, Shopify are some of the companies trying it out, and they're already getting a lot of videos. Lots of people trying to get a job and maybe even go viral. All right, we're about to head out in a second, but not before your moment of economic context. And this one is pretty wild. So the recession caused by the pandemic, it lasted a grand total of, drumroll please, 2 months. According to the National Bureau of Economic Research, it officially ended in April of 2020, making it the shortest recession on record. But you might think, hold up, the economy did not recover last year back in April. And you're right, it didn't. The end of a recession does not mean the economy is fully healed and everything is rosy. Recessions are about periods of economic contraction. So once things start bouncing back, once we start digging ourselves out of the hole, that is when the recession is over, even if said hole is still deep. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. I'm Rima Khreis, and we'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.